Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our Morning Talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In 2001, a group of Afghan tribal leaders agreed to work together to overthrow the Taliban. The man who was at the center of this effort was Abdul Haq. He was, in Afghanistan, a very famous leader in the war against the Soviets. And there were many people who believed that this approach could indeed work to overthrow the Taliban and to set the country on a more stable ground. The United States did not believe in that approach. It failed to support Abdul Haq, and he was ultimately assassinated by the Taliban. In this hour of Focus, we will get the story from Lucy Edwards. In her recent book, The Afghan Solution, she examines the Afghan policy of the West in the time after 9/11, and she makes the argument that it failed, the policy failed, because it was imposed from outside. Her book, The Afghan Solution, the subtitle is The Inside Story of Abdul Haq, the CIA, and How Western Hubris Lost Afghanistan, is published by Bactria Press. Let me tell you a little bit more about her. Lucy Morgan Edwards is former political advisor to the EU ambassador in Kabul, with responsibilities for civil military affairs, narcotics, and security sector reform. She also worked for the United Nations in Kandahar at the height of the Taliban regime. She was an election monitor at the 2002 emergency Loya Jirga. She's also been correspondent for The Economist and Daily Telegraph and has spent a lot of time in Afghanistan. She's joining us this morning by telephone from Geneva, and we're pleased that she could be giving us some of her time. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Also email will-talk@illinois.edu. Folks are certainly welcome to join the conversation. We just ask people to be brief as possible so we can keep things moving along. But anybody is welcome to give us a call. And Ms. Edwards, hello.
Yes, hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I'm sure we'll have an opportunity as we go along here to try to talk a little bit about Afghanistan today. And certainly, I know that you have some thoughts on how it is that the policy that was undertaken by the United States and by the other NATO countries was wrong-headed. But perhaps we'll just start. I'll just start by having you talk about Abdul Haq, because I think your point is, one of your points is that he is someone who, within Afghanistan, is quite well known, but aside from perhaps people who are specialists in studying Afghan politics, outside of Afghanistan, in the West, in the United States, in Britain, he was someone that almost no one knows.
Yes, and thank you for having me on the program today. I think that this really had to do with so much of the problem of the way that we've approached this in the last decade in Afghanistan, is that we've worked with our own ideas instead of understanding the way that things are done within that country and also the personalities in that country. Of course, Abdul Haq, he was killed by the Taliban in October 2001 when he went in to start his mission. He had actually argued for the bombing campaign not to take place because he needed time to get this coalition of people together. Many of whom were in place within the Taliban axis, guys that he'd worked with during the 1980s, commanders that he'd fought with against the Soviets at that stage. But Abdul Haq was well known in the United States in that he was well known in Washington, D.C., by D.C. insiders in the CIA, the State Department, the various organs of state that had to do with that war during the 1980s. And he was also well known in the intelligence services, of course, in the United Kingdom. The problem was that he had never had a particularly easy relationship with the intelligence services, and particularly the CIA, partly because he had criticized the policy back in the 1980s of working through Pakistan. And he had tried to warn that the interests of Pakistan were not the same as those of the West or indeed Afghanistan. And because the CIA worked so closely with Pakistan, he was kind of not very popular because he was criticizing this. And he was therefore belittled somewhat and called Hollywood Haq and so on. But, I mean, the people in my book that I've engaged were journalists and cameramen and photographers who'd spent a lot of time in Afghanistan during the 1980s. And some of them were the people who had the most respect for Abdul-Haq and felt that really we should have taken much more seriously what he had to say back in 2001 in order to avoid the present situation.
It seemed that what he was saying was the argument that he was trying to make to the powers of the West was that really in Afghanistan, support for the Taliban was really rather thin. Even people among people who were allied with the Taliban, he said that certainly the leadership, they were very hardcore, but there weren't that many of them. And his argument was if this was allowed to work, that he could pull away some people from the Taliban and then organize all these people who were opposed to them. The rallying point would be the former king of Afghanistan. And he was making this argument that said, We can take care of the Taliban ourselves. And he was saying to the West, not only is it not a good idea for you to strike them militarily, but it would even be counterproductive.
Absolutely, David. Yes, I mean basically, he understood that if the West began its bombing campaign or had a military presence in Afghanistan that was visible to the population, that would be totally counterproductive to his plan, because it would mean that the people who he was trying to engage with, who he wanted to defect over from the Taliban, because they were relatively moderate, some of these guys, that they might then go away from their posts, go back to their families and their villages, and that other people would be attracted into the country, some of the more extremist elements who might come in from Pakistan from the outside. And that there would be this kind of feeling of the foreigner is attacking us, let's unite. And it would just be way more difficult. The dynamic would change very quickly. And as in fact it did, it changed overnight. When you start bombing a country, the dynamics do change overnight. He wanted to be able to go in and engage these people verbally and on the basis of historic relationships that he had, that both his family had. In fact, he was well known to be capable of working across different tribal lines and ethnic lines, and building consensus. And really this had to do with his record during the anti-Soviet jihad, when he had been one of the most respected commanders and probably the most respected Pashtun commander, because he actually fought the Soviets in Kabul. But he did so very much on the basis of psychological operations, managing to sort of penetrate the Soviet and Afghan communist civil service and army, and to get people to work for him, even though they were under the cover of the communist military or the communist civil service. Mm. So he was very clever.
He did have apparently some within the governments of the United States and Britain. There were some people who did actually think that this could work and that he should be supported.
That's right. And these were the people were some of my key interlocutors in my book that I interviewed. And the story is really from their perspective. From the U.S., there were two brothers called James and Joe Ritchie, who were, I think, from Chicago and also from Colorado. They'd made a lot of money on the Chicago Options Exchange. But they were also partly brought up in Afghanistan when they were kids. Their father had been working there. And James and Joe Ritchie had recognized, they'd actually been trying to work with Abdul-Haq in the 3 or 4 years before 9/11 to provide an alternative to the Taliban. And they had helped him by financing some what they call lawyer jirga meetings. And these were the sort of grand council, the council of shuras and jirgas that the Afghans hold. And they'd held meetings already in Istanbul and in Bonn and in Rome, where the ex-king was. And they had actually had this coalition of Afghan leaders and tribesmen and commanders who had already agreed to buy in to this plan. So James and Joe Ritchie were very interesting, and what they had to say also about what in fact happened, which was not what they had hoped for, but that they were very dispirited by the lack of interest shown by some elements in Washington, D.C., particularly, as they said, ultimately the buck stopped with the CIA. And even though they were able to generate interest in other departments, the White House and so on, that ultimately, even after 9/11 happened, it was normally blocked by the CIA. And this went back to to those 1980s problems or differences of opinion, shall we say, that there had been some station chiefs in the CIA based in Pakistan, rarely traveling into Afghanistan at that stage, we have to say. You know, the Afghans were doing the fighting on the behalf of the West, on behalf of the United States, in terms of the Cold War. But ironically, the CIA agents were not able to travel into Afghanistan to see what was going on because the whole thing was being controlled by the Pakistani intelligence. And part of what came out of my investigation was that the CIA remained way too close to the Pakistani intelligence even after 9/11, to the extent that I have a little anecdote where there was a documentary being made and somebody was interviewing a former CIA station chief, and they casually asked him if he knew the telephone number of the former chief of the Pakistani ISI. And he rolled it off the top of his head, kind of almost a decade after he was out of that theater. And so, you know, this kind of betrayed that sort of very close relationship. And the criticism was that perhaps the CIA were just relying way too much on a single source of intelligence, which was Pakistan. And, of course, with the discovery of bin Laden earlier this year in Abbottabad in Pakistan, that raises great questions as to what degree the Pakistanis have been our ally or not our ally and protecting other interests, whether they're strategic or bin Laden or whatever. But the other people that I interviewed were some British guys, former Marines. One of them was the former head of the British Special Boat Service, and another one was a guy who'd worked as a cameraman in Afghanistan throughout the 80s, and another guy called John Gunston. And they had also tried to lobby in London after 9/11 for Abdul Haq and his plan to be taken seriously. So the book is also, you know, it's both Washington side, but also the London side. What were the political reactions? Why was this support not forthcoming? What does this have to say about the way our intelligence agencies and our departments of state and foreign office in the UK make decisions? And how much knowledge did they really have about Afghanistan? Because it seems when you look at the situation now, 10 years down the line, that we went in there virtually blind, and we're now paying the price for that. Mm.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Lucy Morgan Edwards. She is a journalist, also has experience working for the EU. She was a political advisor to the EU ambassador in Kabul. She also worked for the United Nations in Kandahar at the height of the Taliban regime. She's the author of the recent book, The Afghan Solution, The Inside Story of Abdul Haq, the CIA, and How Western Hubris Lost Afghanistan. Bactria Press is the publisher, and indeed she makes the argument that there was a time, this was actually a plan that was in the works even before 9/11, where some people at least felt that it was possible there would have been an Afghan solution to the problem of the Taliban, and that it would have been better if the West had allowed that to try to work rather than staging the invasion that we did. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Today, as we know, the security situation in Afghanistan is precarious. The government has a very tough time holding any territory outside of the capital, and we have, it seems, that we have a place, a country that is divided among various leaders and their factions, each of them pursuing their individual agendas. And it seems that the problem is getting people to line up behind a central government. And that seems like that's always been a problem with Afghanistan, getting people to line up behind a central government. Do you really think that there's good reason to believe that in this particular case, with what Abdul Haq was trying to do, that he would have been any more successful getting people together than anybody else has been?
I think it's a myth, really, to say that there's never been peace in Afghanistan. That's not quite what you said, but this is something that's promulgated, that there's never been a central government, there's never been peace. I mean, previously, Zahir Shah, the ex-king, he did rule over 40 years of peace from when he was when he first came into power in the 1930s until 1973, when there was a coup d'etat by his cousin. There was always a balance between the regions and the center. And but, you know, what it really rested on was legitimacy and that balance between those leaders in the areas around, the tribal leaders. Unfortunately, what we have done is we failed to understand that. we've failed to work legitimately. We've kind of imposed upon Afghanistan a sort of quasi-westernized state, which just cannot work in a tribal, rural-based country. And we've utterly failed to understand the grassroots, whether it's the tribal structures in the Pashtun area of the south or whether it's more the clan-based structures in the north. But because we've kind of imposed our model, we have failed to understand what is legitimate to these people. And I think that Karzai was a kind of trade-off. He was the man of the United States. He's a puppet. He was nothing compared to Abdul Haq in terms of, you know, he was really a nobody during that war against the Russians. He was virtually the tea boy. I'm sorry to say that, but, you know, he really had no great history. And but he, you know, he's a pliable person. And because of that, because the strategy has been since 9/11 to work with these various strongmen instead of indicting them, which we would have done in other countries, whether that was Sierra Leone or the Balkans, what we've done is we've developed a state that is characterized by a crisis of impunity where you have kind of warlord criminal strongmen becoming ministers and taking over the reins of power and then, of course, running whether great corruption schemes, whether it's the Kabul Bank, whether it's the drugs, whether it's other forms of illicit activities. But Karzai is still the sort of acceptable figurehead, except that he's had to barter power between those different guys and allow them to carry on with their illicit activities in order to stay in power. And, of course, heavily backed up by a Western military presence as well.
Hmm. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone in Atwood, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I just wanted to ask the guest, based on the history of Afghanistan, the Soviet experience, and then the British going further back, does the United States, do we really need to be there? What is the end game? We've lost an incredible amount of blood and treasure pursuing whatever it is we're trying to do there. And I wonder, the other question would be of the current administration, their policies, will it achieve anything that will be worthwhile? Or is there any of the current Republican candidates who's we've not heard much about policy there because of all the other sideline events they seem to engage in? What are they proposing that might bring, you know, actually some good from that whole situation? And I'll call up or I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, those are obviously very big questions, and I think that what it points to is that I think that a lot of people in the United States are really not sure what the interest of the United States is in Afghanistan, particularly now that we've gotten past the point where we're well past the point where the Taliban no longer run the country. Osama bin Laden is dead. The administration now has announced that there will be a withdrawal of U.S. forces, but I don't think anybody really believes that that means that the United States won't be involved in Afghanistan in the future. I think that the question seems to be, well, what interest does the United States have in this country?
I think that the United States continues to have a broader geopolitical interest in that region, and not just in Afghanistan, but it's now looking like Pakistan is looking very shaky. Pakistan, of course, has nuclear weapons. Really, Pakistan is the problem and has to be sorted out. But, of course, the U.S. is interested perhaps to be there because of the proximity to China and particularly to Iran, which is also on the western border. And so, yes, there are those sort of wider interests. I think in terms of what would happen if the U.S. pulls out, I think, as is already evidenced, I mean, the insecurity is growing all the time. It's getting worse. The civil war never really ended, and we failed to understand that we were basically intervening in a civil war that had been ongoing, and we were kind of arming one side against the other. So I feel that this idea of just building up the Afghan security forces, whether they're police, army, whether they're militias, that is just going to make the situation much worse, because there is not adequate representation of the different ethnic groups, for example, in the officer class of the army. So at the moment, it's kind of like a Tajik-dominated Trojan horse, which would be potentially used as an army against the Pashtun. And I think we've also failed to understand that this was never a situation that you were going to be able to win militarily. I don't know what General Petraeus and General McChrystal were thinking when they came up with this idea for the surge, which, by the way, has cost, Afghanistan was costing the U.S. something like $35 billion per year back in 2005-06. But for this year alone, it's going to be something like $117 billion, and that's just on military expenditure. And this is largely because of the very much increased troop presence of American troops in Afghanistan. My interest in writing this book was really to try to explore and to show how you could achieve so much more with much less money, because it's not so much about the amount of money you put in. In fact, the more money you put in, the more you're actually going to attract the wrong kind of local leaders, the kind of guys who just want to make money quickly, not the legitimate local leadership. But that I was interested in really exploring something that was potentially much more sustainable in the long term, an internal solution, and something that Afghans would find relevant to themselves, because I don't think that they find this idea of Western-style democracy and elections particularly relevant when they have no security and they have terrible poverty still, and the problems they're facing with drought, et cetera, et cetera.
Just to be clear about something, because I think it's an interesting and important point. What you're saying is here, the situation in 2001 was, even at that time, there was a civil war going on in the country, and that is something that had been happening. The Soviets were there. The Afghans managed to come together to drive out the Soviets, but then they started fighting each other. And that was the case right at the time of 9/11. And that what we did, because we made this decision that the way to go would be to back this coalition known as the Northern Alliance, which was mostly Tajik, we weighed in on the side of one of the parties in the war, and that they really enabled them to have perhaps more power and influence in the government which was to come than they would have otherwise. But it seems like what you're saying is that was something the United States really didn't understand.
Yeah, of course. The Soviets had left over a decade before. They left in 1989. The communist government continued until 1992. And then between 92 and 96, you had this terrible civil war between the different strongmen who had been armed essentially by the West. But, of course, it had been the Pakistanis who were divvying up that money and the guns and the weapons. And the Pakistanis were really trying to back people who would support their strategic interests in Afghanistan, of course, against India, perhaps. They wanted more of this sort of general... They essentially wanted people they could buy. So that's why they supported people like Hikmat Shah, who was a very, very guy with a lot of blood on his hands, but very little localized legitimacy amongst the Pashtun in the south. But So then fast forward to 9/11, which is almost a decade after the Soviet pullout and several years after that civil war had started. I think that what we did was we were still in that Cold War mentality of my enemy's enemy is my friend. So the Taliban had been absolutely demonized by the Western media. I mean, I actually worked in Kandahar during the Taliban when bin Laden was living down the road. I was running aid projects. And I found that a lot of the guys in my office, relatively well-educated, actually supported the Taliban. And the reason why was they felt that these guys had brought stability, had cleared out the warlordism of the early 1990s, and that there was relative peace. Of course, the civil war went on, but it was right up in the northeast of the country. So after 9/11 happened, the U.S. and the West come in, and we decide that everyone who's a Pashtun must be a Taliban. But that, of course, was not what Abdul Haq was saying. Abdul Haq was a Pashtun, but he was a Pashtun who, although able to talk to the Taliban, was one of those people who felt that it was time for a new order, and that this new order would be best achieved through an internal implosion of that regime. But we totally overlooked that. We decided we'll just back the Northern Alliance, the Tajik warlords, against the Taliban. But we essentially built a government that alienated the largest ethnic group, which was the Pashtun. And we did that because we were so black and white, we assumed that everyone who was a Pashtun must support the Taliban, but that just wasn't the case. And that's why you have the insurgency taking place in those Pashtun areas, in that Pashtun belt along the south and the east, because these people have been politically alienated and they have not seen the services that were promised. They have still the pressures of Pakistan and I mean, for example, that border along the east, there's been quite a lot of incursions by the Pakistani army and disputes. And, of course, the fact that the U.S. and the West has exacerbated those problems in that tribal area by backing tribal leaders who are not necessarily the most legitimate of people in that region.
Mm-hmm. It's really one of the things that I think is really interesting here when you look at Abdul Haq and what he was trying to do. And as we said, he really believed that the Taliban regime was so unpopular that it was vulnerable to collapse and that he could organize enough people with this project of his to pressure the Taliban and to drive them from power. And one of the things that's really interesting here that you write about is among his supporters, among his allies, was Jalaluddin Haqqani, this man who now we know as for his group, the Haqqani Network, now fighting against NATO forces and the Karzai government. And when Abdul Haq was killed, then Haqqani went off, and now we know that it seems at least that he's working with the Pakistani security apparatus and is causing a lot of trouble. But going back to this point that we're talking about, he was actually working with Abdul Haq and at least wasn't an outright opponent of the West.
Yeah, that was also the majorly significant and strong point of Abdul Haq's plan, was that he was able to engage guys who he'd worked with during the 1980s. And in fact, Abdul Haq his family had belonged to one of the sort of politico-military factions during the 1980s, which was called Hizb Islami. Now, there was Hizb Islami Hikmatyar, and then there was Hizb Islami run by a guy called Khalis, who was Mullah Khalis. And they were not necessarily moderate parties, but Abdul Haq himself was much more of an independent guy and became much more moderate. But at the beginning of the 1980s, he had actually initially been trained in guerrilla warfare by Jalaluddin Haqqani in Paktia. And so I believe that really that Abdul Haq, and apparently his brother said that Haqqani had a lot of respect for him, that if anybody was going to persuade the Haqqanis to come over with this plan, and given that these guys, of course, in Paktia in the east, were very pro the monarchy and very against any kind of external interference, I really believe that if anyone was going to be able to get those Haqqanis on board with a solution to topple the Taliban and start a new order around the ex-king, it would have been Abdul Haq. And, you know, that was just a majorly missed opportunity because, you know, even the United States says that they just really don't even have any way of tackling the Haqqani network. And I think right now, in terms of talks with the Taliban and dialogue with the Taliban for negotiated political settlement, I think still the Haqqanis are a major wild card for the West. And it's, you know, really unknown to what degree they might cooperate or whether they're still going to maintain themselves as a kind of a wing of the Pakistani military and intelligence establishment.
Our guest in this hour focused Lucy Morgan Edwards. Her book is The Afghan Solution. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2012 lecture series presents The Eurasian Angular Harp, Crossing Cultures Ancient to Modern, with Bo Lauergren and Tomoko Sugawara on Tuesday, April 3rd at 4 p.m. in the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum. More information is available at the Center for Advanced Study website.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you each week. In the second hour today, we'll be talking about how ideas about parenting change from one place to the next and how it is that people's influences on how they raise their children, how people's ideas about how they raise their children is indeed influenced by other people, other places. Our guest in the second hour will be Pei Cha Lan. She is a sociologist at National Taiwan University and will be here on the campus to speak. Also tomorrow morning, we'll have another visit with Jim Rybacki. He is a pharmacist, and he is the author of The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. So if you're interested in asking questions about medicines that you're taking, tomorrow would be the time to do that. You can check the schedule by going to our website, will.illinois.edu. You can also listen to past programs there. You can find us on Twitter at Will Public Media, and we're also on Facebook. In this hour of focus, our guest is Lucy Morgan Edwards. She is a journalist, author, former political advisor to the EU ambassador in Kabul. She also worked for the United Nations in Kandahar at the height of the Taliban regime. She was doing work supervising community and urban water supply projects. She also has been a correspondent for The Economist and The Daily Telegraph and has spent quite a lot of time in Afghanistan. She's the author of a recent book that we're talking about this morning. Again, the title of her book is The Afghan Solution, The Inside Story of Abdul Haq, the CIA, and How Western Hubris Lost Afghanistan. Bactria Press is the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Abdul Haq went into, he had this plan which we have talked about. He went into Afghanistan to try to make this happen. He, I think, was warned not to go, and he was captured fairly quickly. I think he was captured by Taliban and he was killed. Mm-hmm. And there apparently are some questions though about whether or not the Taliban were tipped off to his presence, possibly by the ISI, by the Pakistani security mm-hmm. agency. What exactly is known about that? Is that something that you could pin down?
Who tipped him off? Well, that's hearsay. I think I go into a lot more detail in the book, particularly with my interview with James Ritchie, who was the American who was trying to fund and to support Abdul Haq, who was trying to get help for him in Washington, D.C., and was actually sitting in his office in Peshawar waiting. In fact, James wanted to go into Afghanistan with him, but Abdul Haq said, no, you mustn't. It'd be too dangerous for you. But also, I think, possibly felt that this had to be very much an Afghan initiative. And so, yes, people need to read the book to see a little bit more about what James says about that. But one point to make is that Abdul Haq, yes, he was advised not to go in, but he was, first of all, he had asked for the West not to bomb Afghanistan. He said, listen, I need 2 weeks to see whether this is going to fly, and just 2 weeks before you start bombing, because we can maybe get this thing together without the need for the West to bomb. But because the bombing did start on the 7th of October, he was majorly impeded in what he was trying to achieve. But still, he recognized that the great danger was that the Northern Alliance would be, what strategy the West chose to do instead was to bomb through Taliban front lines north of Kabul and have the Northern Alliance advance on Kabul. And Abdul Haq really saw the danger in that. He'd already had his experiences with Mahmoud and with the various leaders in the early 90s, and he knew that if the Northern Alliance took Kabul, that it would be very, very difficult for the Pashtun to get a look in terms of the new settlement that was going to follow. And in fact, what did happen was the Northern Alliance did indeed take Kabul. Fahim was by then leader after Masood was killed on the 9th of September, before 9/11. And they took over the various ministries. They took over all of the equipment from the departing units of the Afghan National Army. And they were suddenly in the reins of power. And this was then... they were then given political legitimacy at the Bonn Agreement in December 2001, and then also in the Emergency Law Agenda, which I attended in June 2002 as an election monitor. They were given political legitimacy. Now, a lot of these guys were basically war criminals, and we had decided that that was a good shortcut for the rest of the decision-makers, the CIA or the various people in charge, had decided that this was going to be the easiest way. So we were looking at this in a very short-term perspective, because what we did do was we built a state that was characterized by having criminal elements within it from the start. And instead of sidelining them politically or maybe having them go before some kind of due process, they were able to take over the reins of power. Now, Abdul Haq had always talked about a structure. I need to go. I need to start my mission to get a structure in place. He was trying to get to Kabul before the Northern Alliance took the whole thing in order to ensure some kind of balanced political representation in the new order that was going to follow. And unfortunately, he got killed before that he was able to achieve that. And a lot of that had to do with the bombings having started. However, as I discovered from my interview, many of the guys that he had in place through the south, whether it was Jalalabad, Ghazni, Kandahar, even parts of Kabul, some of those cities in the south actually fell to his men, like Arif Shah Jahan in Ghazni, for example. He had the Taliban corps commander in Jalalabad, who was his guy. So some of these cities fell literally without a shot being fired because his men were in place, and they were able to do to have that sort of handover of what they call it, purchasing political power through dialogue. They could see the way that things were going, and there didn't need to be much fighting. And that was what he had. That was what he was hoping for. But of course, it was too late for the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that part of the you argue that perhaps the United States and the CIA relied too much on the intelligence and the perspective of the Pakistanis when it came to Afghanistan, and so because Haq had been critical of the ISA, the ISI, then they belittled him and talked in very negative ways, I'm sure, to the United States about Haq. So there was that. But you wonder, was the administration, perhaps the Bush administration, too? They wanted too much to do something very big and dramatic, and that a quiet, more behind the scenes approach just wouldn't have suited them.
Yeah, of course. I think that there was, of course, the need to be seen to be doing something very big and dramatic after 9/11. But the problem was that they were not essentially listening to some of the people who really knew the country. They were, of course, taking their advice from the CIA and elements in the CIA, perhaps, who had more influence than they should have had in the type of decisions that were taken. And when I say this, I mean going back to the fact that even during the 1980s, the CIA had starved Abdul Haq of the munitions that he had needed to fight the Soviets. Despite this, he had been shown to be such an effective commander that, in fact, he'd blown a munitions dump in Karga, which is north of Kabul, in 1987, in an event that some people said turned the war in favor of the West and led to the Russians having to pull out a couple of years later. That, you know, he was essentially belittled all the way down the line from the 1980s, even through the 90s. In the 90s, he pulled out because he didn't agree with the Civil War. He didn't want to be one of those factional commanders fighting. But certainly around, like before 9/11 and around the time of 9/11, the interviews that I had with the Ritchie brothers, which threw light on what was going on and who was deciding and who had what personal vengeances against who, and in fact there was a lot of bad mouthing of Abdul Haq. And I think definitely the CIA, former station chiefs and others, perhaps had relied way too much on the Pakistani ISI. And even until today, there is still denial by some people, some writers and people about, I mean, Anatole Levin, who denied that the Pakistanis are giving logistical support to the Taliban, who doesn't mention their fostering of the extremist groups, the non-Taliban, the Tajik extremist groups from the 1970s in those tribal areas. These were things that Abdul Haq was very aware of even during the 90s, and part of what I was fascinated by was letters that he'd written to people like Margaret Thatcher and Peter Thompson, your own former ambassador, trying to warn about the training camps and trying to warn about the fundamentalist elements that were there during that stage. But at no stage was he listened to.
Hmm. We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of focus. Again, our guest is Lucy Morgan Edwards, and we're talking about her book, The Afghan Solution. The subtitle is The Inside Story of Abdul Haq, the CIA, and How Western Hubris Lost Afghanistan. Bactria Press is the publisher, and again, tells the story of this man, Abdul Haq, who was an important leader in Afghanistan during the war against the Soviets, and proposed a plan to the West that would bring together enough of his fellow fighters to topple the Taliban regime that he argued was very unpopular and was actually very vulnerable. It would have been, as the title of her book suggests, an Afghan solution to the problem of the Taliban. Some people in the West thought it would be a good idea, but not certainly enough of them within the government of the United States. After 9/11, the United States decided that it needed to do something very dramatic. It bombed the country, something that Abdul Haq said, don't do that. It'll ruin the possibility for what it is I think could happen. But now we know just exactly where things went. And she, Lucy Edwards, really makes the argument in her book that this was a real lost opportunity for Afghanistan. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We also have email if you would like to interact with us that way. That's certainly a possibility. Will-talk@illinois.edu. Just to talk a little bit about where we are now, what possibility do you think that there is that the United States and perhaps the current government of Afghanistan can talk with and have some kind of relationship with the Taliban or with some elements of the Taliban?
I think it's looking very difficult, and particularly after these recent episodes of the Quran burning and this massacre in Kandahar by this renegade soldier. The Taliban, I think, really feel like they have the upper hand, that they want all foreign forces out of the country, that they don't necessarily want to follow the constitution of President Karzai. They've also been talking about not wanting to talk with the government, that they see Karzai as an illegitimate puppet. But, you know, he's kind of all that the West has, that there isn't really a great deal of choice. There aren't many other people to work with. And I don't know if the United States is going to achieve its objective of maintaining at least a kind of presence of military bases in the region. I think that the Afghans are going to be able to drive a very hard bargain. And, of course, the government, I see Karzai actually kind of mirroring the Taliban demands, because he knows that when the foreigners leave, that he's going to have to deal with them. So the other thing I'd say is I think it's very difficult for foreigners to conduct these talks. This is a characteristic of the Afghans that goes right back through their history of having non-interference by invaders, that they don't want to be seen to be puppets, that really for the talks to have had long-term credibility, legitimacy, whatever you call it, that you need to have Afghans doing this. It mustn't be sort of visible that this has been outsiders who are running the show. And again, this goes back to why I felt that what Abdul Haq was proposing was very significant, and that we really failed to kind of understand that.
Mm-hmm. And now that the United States and NATO are talking about an official end to the mission there in 2014 and essentially withdrawal of the, mm-hmm. the bulk of the troops, do you think, and does everybody really expect that, or does anybody expect that the current government, that the Karzai government, could withstand the withdrawal of NATO?
I mean, I think it's going to be very difficult for the Karzai government, because they have not done anything, really. They have not been a credible government since 2001, 2002. We've had all these scandals like the Kabul bank scandal, the corruption scandal. But again, this goes back to the idea of people say if you lie down with dogs, you get fleas. If you use criminal warlords as your main interlocutors, and you allow them to hijack the state, which is what we essentially did. We kind of gave them the state of Afghanistan, and then we gave them the political legitimacy at the Loya Jirga, which I opened the book with, because this was really where we hijacked the democratic process. There had been democratic elections in spring 2002, and I was a monitor at those elections, and there was real hope that this was a rebirth of the country. But what the UN and Ambassador Omar Khalilzad, the U.S. ambassador, then did was to make this kind of Faustian pact with these strongmen on the eve of this Grand Council of Elders. And those guys then swept into that meeting with their big cars and their rocket-propelled grenades and their bodyguards. And at that stage, all the democratically elected candidates were essentially sidelined. And although the women were initially challenging these guys and saying, you know, you guys ruined our country, what are you doing here? And in fact, they weren't supposed to be there under the rules of the Bonn Agreement, and they weren't supposed to have voting rights. What then happened was the rest of the meeting took place in a VIP side tent, and the democratically elected candidates had nothing to say. And that's really, this was not covered by the press at the time, because the press were not present in the tent. They were kind of shoved off into the Intercontinental Hotel. So this was really not covered. And then, of course, the Iraq war kicked off. But for me, that was a very important turning point, and that's where we lost the whole idea of democracy, really, in Afghanistan in 2002.
Mm-hmm. We're coming down to the point. We have about 4 or 5 minutes. I do have another caller. We'll get them. And this is someone in Effingham, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. It's kind of an overview, if your guest would comment about it. This practice has been going on for hundreds of years, and we continue to do it, whoever the main party is, which now the West, sweep in and culturally destroy what is there and try to institute their own. And that practice, mm-hmm. how much further, how much longer can that go on and have any form of success? And thank you very much.
Yes, that's a difficult question, and of course it is a very relevant question when you look at what's going on in the Middle East with the Arab Spring, with Libya, possibly with Syria, with other countries. And again, you know, we're dealing with tribal societies here, very ancient societies, rural. We think that these are, you know, totally unsophisticated people. It's not the case. They have their traditions. And, you know, this is another reason why I felt compelled to write this book, that I wanted to throw some light on what I discovered with these tribal people and how, in fact, they do have forms of democracy, even in their tribal governance systems, even in their shuras. And that, you know, this is something that they find legitimate to work with. And on the women's question, the West has done nothing to protect Afghan women because we've done nothing to protect human rights in general in Afghanistan, which we could have done back in 2001, 2002. We made the choice not to do that, so therefore now we're again leaving behind nothing for the women. But, you know, even culturally in Pakistan, I found the women's situation to be just as bad, almost sometimes worse than in Afghanistan. So, you know, we could totally fail to understand. And I think this is partly the fault of the media. In fact, I lay quite a lot of the blame at the door of the media, this idea of simplifying and making everything black and white when it's not.
Well, given that now the situation that exists in Afghanistan is much of the making of the West as it is of theirs, and that now we have this impending troop withdrawal, which would no doubt only make the security situation worse and could contribute to the possible fall of the current government, what now in the next couple of years could the United States and Britain and Europe do that would try to set the country on a somewhat more stable foundation? Is there anything that we could do?
I think what we could do is, I mean, of course, there has to be a regional political settlement that we have to try to bring in the surrounding countries to have everyone realize that it's in their best interest to have stability and security. And one way of achieving that is through cross-boundary trade, whether that's energy or whether it's fruit, agricultural products, and so on, that people need to understand that that's in their interest. And, of course, Pakistan being fairly unstable now would probably be amenable to that. They have a different government and so on. I think we also have to really stop looking at these problems through the lens of the military. I mean, these are just not problems that you can solve militarily or by body count. You know, that's a gross mistake, and it's a huge waste of the American taxpayers' dollars from the perspective of what I have seen in the country. I think that we need to really work more with people who really know the country, more like anthropologists, try to have more community-led development where the communities really participate and choose the projects, but not throw so much money at it, because quite often that is not the way to attract the best people and the best local leadership. So, but, you know, we also need to visibly reduce our presence and stop being seen to be controlling the situation too greatly. But then we'll probably need to have some kind of a presence there in order to ensure that that outright civil war doesn't just immediately break out when we leave. Because I think there is a lot of anger in the country. And not just between the Pashtuns and the Tajiks. I think there's even anger towards the foreigners now, as evidenced last week by this discovery of suicide vests inside the Ministry of Defense in Kabul. I mean, that is the heart of our allies. So why are these guys, why do they have suicide vests in the heart of the MOD? I think we have to ask.
It certainly seems that we're in a very difficult position because we don't really have that many friends in the region. It seems that we don't have friends in Tehran, and we can't seem to rely on our friends in Pakistan.
That's right. I mean, I think it's quite good that the United States is kind of waking up to the fact that the Pakistanis have different strategic interests to themselves. Of course, I think India is more of an ally, but we have to balance the interests of India and Pakistan. I don't agree with this idea that Pakistan has the right to interfere in Afghanistan, which it kind of has seemed to have traditionally awarded itself since the 1980s. We really have to work with Afghans and not just kind of do a quick political fix with the Pakistanis and then leave and saying that, you know, the Pakistanis control the Taliban, therefore we can just do a deal with them and then leave. That's not the case. A lot of the Afghans who have given political space to the Taliban have done so because we have failed when it's come to corruption or the type of guys that we have installed in power there who are not popular, perhaps, locally.
Well, there we'll have to leave it for people who want to read more on the subject. Look for the book we've talked about by our guest, Lucy Morgan Edwards. It's The Afghan Solution, published by Bactria Press. Ms. Edwards, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. And just wanted to say it's actually distributed by Pluto Press and Palgrave Macmillan in the United States.
Ah, very good.
I have a website, www.lucymorganedwards.com.
So that way they can find out more about you and the book.
That's
good.
Right.
Well, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.